Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:17 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is September 4th. I saw this screenshot from Reddit in here today. The poor chap is saying, "Am I doing this right?" And one thing that I thought was particularly interesting, outside of the fact that there were a large number of options were down well in excess of 50%, some in the order of 91%, is that this person was still trading in September 4th calls, and that means that they would have expired today, and he was still long of them into the decline yesterday. So that is really playing it close to the wire, but what it also suggests is a degree of inexperience. And what it also tells us is that there are a large number of retail investors that are highly active in the market. Now, when we think about Apple, the share pulled back violently for a day and a half, and then it rebounded in here today, and it was way off the lows. So up very mildly. The price pulled back from 137, I think, down to about $110 and has since rebounded. There has been a clear trend in the stock market over the last while to buy the dips, and that certainly came into effect in here today. The size of the pullback that we'd seen on the NASDAQ was reasonably similar sized to what we'd seen on previous occasions yesterday. Obviously, the pullback down to low in here today would have been the largest pullback since the rebound really got underway back in March. But then it really will depend on whether one wants to simply look at the closing values or the intraday values. Even still, we've had a big downward dynamic in the form of the pullback yesterday, and we have a wide overextension relative to the trend mean. It's in the region of the big psychological 12,000 level, so it's not at all beyond the bounds possibility that we get some consolidation here and that the market pauses for a while at least. But then people will begin to ask the question whether we've seen the peak or whether this is a peak. And that's a big question. So I think we have to then start to examine some of the questions or some of the factors behind why we've had such a big move in the first place. Well, it's all down to low interest rates. The fact that Tesla can go from $100 to $500 in the space of 6 months isn't because they've suddenly started selling hundreds of thousands of additional cars every week, but rather that they are benefiting enormously from the low interest rate environment, the increasing regulation, the Green New Deals, and the fact that carbon credits are still really quite well bid, and that their competitors are essentially paying for the company's expansion. Now, the share was well off the lows as well in here today, and it has found support in the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range. So, based upon the history of this advance and the extremely low interest rate environment that we have overall, well, then I think what we're being treated to is another example of where investors are willing to buy the dips. Now, Treasury yields, though, were higher in here today by about 8 basis points. So, investors are taking some of that money that plowed into bonds and putting it back into the stock market. When we think about the gold market, then what we're presented with still is a gold price that can hold the $1,900 area. Now, there are a number of dynamics that are worth considering inside the wider economic environment. And I think there are two charts in particular that really stood out to me today as having a lot of value and really worth our consideration. Now, let me just find the first one. This is from a report from the ECB. I'm going to post it in comment of the day today, or at least in the weekend reading. And it clearly highlights that following the Lehman bankruptcy, the credit multiplier in our money multiplier from the banking sector just completely dissipated. There was a massive step downwards. and the monetary base had to increase substantially to take up the slack. And since we've seen the multiplier start to improve from about 2015 or late 2014 through to 2017, then the monetary base had really stabilized and in fact had contracted a little. But M2 has done nothing but rise in that intervening period. So what we're really being shown with this graphic is that the banking sector has been handicapped for most of the last 12 years. And then when we think about M2 now, well, we've had this massive increase in M2, and it's a huge step change again, and it is also in response to this debilitating effect in the credit multiplier, because when the economy gets locked down, well, then your velocity of money disappears, but also the ability of banks to lend is completely impaired. So this payday protection initiatives that were introduced in response to the pandemic, they have been somewhat enabling in terms of getting banks to lend without having the punitive risk of those loans going bad. But the reality is that banks are still in a very difficult situation. They have been heavily regulated, even though those regulations have been eased somewhat during the Trump administration. They are handicapped again by extraordinarily low interest rates. And then they have the uncertainty about the economic outlook, because there is still a big uncertainty and an unknown about how many people are going to eventually declare bankruptcy, what's going to happen when the moratorium on evictions eventually lapse, and what's going to happen in terms of wages, and then, of course, regulation and political outcomes as well. So that pretty much ensures that the onus for creating a money multiplier falls still on the central bank. And the Federal Reserve has basically said that they are not going to raise interest rates until they have clear evidence of inflation returning. But I thought that this also was particularly interesting. It's depicting productivity in the dark blue line, then the dotted blue line is hourly pay, and then the core CPI. And there is this very strong correlation that productivity growth diverged from hourly pay back in the mid-1970s, and then CPI peaked a couple of years later. And since then, CPI has been contracting. Wage growth has been growing, but only very modestly. And then we have productivity growth, which has been trending higher for a good long period of time. Now, there is certainly a slowdown in the trend of productivity over the course of the last few years, but the divergence between productivity and hourly pay has done nothing but rise over the course of the last 40 years. Now, if that's the case, could we then draw the conclusion that hourly pay and CPI inflation are linked or inherently linked, or are we unlikely to see inflationary pressures rise until we see meaningful moves in hourly pay? Well, that's a tempting conclusion. I think there's certainly some rationale behind it. Then we can think about the fact that when we start to think about the money multiplier, how is it that you can get velocity of money moving? Well, if people are earning more, if they are in a sounder financial position, then their ability to access credit improves. If you get looser regulations on top of the clear raise or in credit conditions for people, then you may in fact get more businesses opening. I had a conversation last night with a good friend who has a garment manufacturing factory in downtown Los Angeles. He had a couple of extremely interesting things to say. The first was that he was on the cusp of really going out of business in March when one of his suppliers, and he had been awaiting a substantial shipment of fabric from Mexico, and then they locked down Los Angeles, so he was really on tenterhooks whether he was ever going to be able to take delivery. But one of his contractors said that they were manufacturing masks. He gave them a prototype and said just rip it off if they wanted to. He started manufacturing masks, then he got a designation as an essential business and was able to stay open, and that basically saved his year. But what he also said was that there has been an enormous divergence in the kinds of success that his customers have had, because what he said was that the kinds of garments he's manufacturing appeal to people who want to wear something on might be considered skimpy clothing. Let's be somewhat political and say that. They're politically correct. Now, what he said was that the customers that he's selling to that are appealing to the black community have been doing fantastically well because they benefited from the $600 additional unemployment benefit. So, where people that had been coming to him once every couple of weeks for merchandise were coming a couple of times a week. So he saw a big increase in demand for clothing from that segment. The businesses that had been relying on the Latino community have disappeared because, with a large illegal population, then those people were not getting the $600 in additional unemployment benefits, and therefore the Latino businesses are suffering really considerably more than others. But what he also said was that he had noticed around where the garment district is and the fashion districts are in downtown Los Angeles that a large number of new businesses have started up, and they are all selling online. So that is creating additional, it's a transition phase because the mom-and-pop stores basically disappeared with the advent of Amazon. And now, with the complete abouts turn and a large number of new people selling online, well, the input costs are considerably lower. And now there are also demands for additional wages. Then you have got enabling companies like Shopify, which are doing well and then have also paused in the last while. And certainly around this $1,000 level, there is some appetite for some buying and selling. But it was well off the lows as well in here today. But it's the kind of company that does do well from individuals starting to create their own websites and looking for an e-commerce solution. Wix is an additional company that does exactly the same thing, and it was also well off its lows in here today. Now, there have been significant losses of momentum in these shares. There is obviously the potential for some additional consolidation, but there is certainly, I think, the potential that we're going to see more people starting businesses. And then when we think about the wage growth, well, it popped on the upside, and I think that's an aberration in the data because it's average hourly earnings, and then when you reduce the number of people working, and then you can basically fiddle with the levels. But the reality, I think, is much closer to around 4%. People are demanding more wages. It makes sense that if you give people more money than they were making when they were working in unemployment benefits, then the reality is that they're going to find it very difficult to go back to school. or excuse me, go back to work and earn less. And the reason I said school is because I was also thinking that my children are now inseparable from their phones as if they weren't inseparable before. But when they go back to school, are they going to be comfortable giving up their phones during class time? It's going to be a big transition. There's going to be, I think, certainly some reticence to do that. And I think it is going to be a big transition to get back into the normal flow. When we look at the proposals that are coming through from various politicians, it's quite likely we're going to get a significant move in minimum wages, up to about $15 an hour. Well, $15 an hour in high-cost cities is perhaps justifiable, but in places where the average wage is considerably lower and the cost of living is much lower, bringing the minimum wage up to $15 is an enormous pay jump, and it represents clear cost inflation for the corporate sector. But it could also be the animating factor behind a jump in inflationary pressures. So not only do we have the full impetus on the central bank to try and create a money multiplier and to massively increase the monetary base in response to the economic slowdown, but then we also have the other side of the equation where there is a clear demand for higher wages, and higher wages would clearly then factor through into inflationary pressures. When we think about the total return on bonds, then the Merrill Lynch Total Return Index for 10-year Treasury futures has pretty much gone nowhere now for the last 6 months. It's one of the most impressive uptrends in history. It has done practically nothing but rise since 1980. We had an important loss of momentum between about 2016 and 2018, and then it popped on the upside with the pandemic. But we're at really rather extraordinary levels, and the total return going up from really pennies on the dollar, our pennies relative to the value that it is right now to 2,500, is a spectacular advance. It's mirrored by the compression in yields that we see everywhere. We don't have quite the same amount of back history for 10-year gilts, but it's down to 26 basis points. When we then think about German bunds, well, they've been negative for a while, and they're still negative at 50 basis points. So this compression in yields is a totally global phenomenon, but we reach an important Rubicon when you get down to zero. One of the most profound impacts it has is on risk parity strategies. That's one of the things that Bridgewater has been warning about now for most of the last couple of years, that and it speaks to the kind of mania that we get evolving in markets when things get to a point where we've gone past the disbelief stage, we are past the acceptance stage and into the mania. Then it's one of the defining characteristics of a mania is a tolerance for the unbelievable to be seen as true or contradiction. Well, the contradiction in the bond markets is simple, that you can make money when you're getting a negative yield and you're guaranteed to make a loss if you hold until maturity. Well, it's not particularly pressing when you're looking at the 10-year, because there are going to be some people that think, well, I'll be gone, I'll sell out before it gets to 10 years. That's certainly not something that is going to be pressing. But then when we look at the 2-year, it's even more depressed, and it's down to minus 70 basis points. I'm very much reminded of that retail trader who was still holding call options that were due to expire the day after and was surprised that they were very volatile. Well, that's one of the key characteristics of negative interest rates and zero yields overall, that the sensitivity of assets to interest rates becomes exponentially larger the closer you get to zero. So when we think about the outlook for the stock market and the outlook for the bond market, then we have to pay particular attention to any whiff of inflation. So we're still in this environment where there is reticence to think that we're ever going to get out of the coronavirus. But the reality is that people can deal with very trying circumstances rather quickly. Even if we don't get a vaccine in the short term, then behavior has already changed. People are wearing more masks, they're washing their hands more often, and they are abiding by some form of social distancing. People are also very much aware of the fact that the number of fatalities is heavily concentrated in elderly people. And the number of elderly people, by definition, is already a declining number. The millennial generation, which are mostly in their 30s or late 20s now, then they are the biggest demographic group in a number of countries, and they are comparatively unaffected by the coronavirus. There have only been a little more than 1,000 deaths in people under the age of 30, and there have been significantly more in people with pre-existing conditions. Of course, when people talk about pre-existing conditions, the majority of people have got some form of condition by the time they get to 75. So whether that's going to be a heart condition or hypertension, then certain or diabetes, there are there the vast majority of elderly people have got some form of pre-existing condition. But nonetheless, older people are more at risk. But then younger people can start to go back to work one way or the other. And quite the same need to quarantine children and to avoid school is less pressing where there are fewer infections. My sister's daughter went off to the first year of kindergarten, walking off to school with no mask in Dublin earlier this week. And I just thought it was an incredible contrast to what's being foisted upon kids in Los Angeles, where they're going to make-believe school online. So, one way or the other, people are learning to live with the coronavirus. But the reality is that technological innovation remains extremely impressive. Now, the Nasdaq Biotech Index has been pulling back for the last 6 weeks, and it found at least near-term support in the region of the trend mean in here today. So this has been an orderly process of mean reversion, and that area is now coinciding with the region of the peak from back in 2015. So arguably, what we are now seeing is a first step above the base. Now, I think that there is the world of difference between the positive outlook for the biotech sector generally, and the mixed outlook for the vaccine producers, because there are a large number of vaccine producers. There are also a large number of potential success stories that may arise. There has been a large amount of money plowed into the sector to develop new vaccines, and this is a proof of concept trial phase for genetic solutions to really intransigent problems. So it has compressed the time to a vaccine by about 75%, taking it from 3 years down to about 10 months. It's quite likely that we're going to have at least initial results from a phase 3 trial in October, and that we'll have the vaccine rolled out at some point next year. Quite whether these vaccine companies will succeed in making any money from it is an entirely different question, because there's going to be a lot of competition with a lot of vaccines coming to market at the same time. But the much bigger picture is that it clearly demonstrates the efficacy of genetic solutions, and that represents a really quite profound change in terms of the speed with which really impressive solutions can be brought to market. That is most particularly true of any kind of genetic ailment, whether it is cystic fibrosis or any of those intransigent problems. And then additionally, will there be other solutions for genetic ailments? Will there be anti-aging treatments that arise as a result of these kinds of genetic enhancements? Will there be more desire for the customization of infants? These are the potential outcomes from these kinds of solutions. They're certainly not going to be permissioned in every country, but we've already got evidence that China is experimenting on babies and bringing babies to full term with genetic enhancements. So this is already happening, and the proof of use case that we've seen today with the production of vaccines is likely to be an accelerant for this kind of innovation in every facet of the genetic solutions market, and going from customized medicine all the way through to customized individuals. Now, the big question, though, is the boost to confidence that the vaccine will have. I do think that is the primary reason why we've had this pullback over the last 3 days, because investors are asking the simple question. We are extraordinarily levered to low interest rates. And therefore, what happens when the velocity of money starts to increase? We're starting to see that the economies of the world are doing better. The velocity of money doesn't get updated but once a quarter, and then it's done so with a lag. So it's not exactly a real-time indicator, but the stock market is already pricing in that we're in full recovery mode, that there is quite likely to be a significant recovery next year. Every economy in the world is predicting that we're going to get a rebound next year. So 2020 has been a period of synchronized global economic contraction, and 2021 is likely to be a period of synchronized global economic expansion. Now, the big question is, well, are we going to have an infrastructure-led boom? Copper prices shook off the weakness yesterday and rallied in a dynamic manner back above the 300 cent level in here today. It is really quite possible that it is completing its base formation. The London Metals Index, which is a composite of the six major industrial resources, has got a very similar pattern, and the most important thing it's done has been to break the downtrend from the peak down from 2018. If we spread out and look at the unweighted continuous commodity index, then it's back above 400. It hasn't quite been able to push on to new recovery highs, but this has been an impressive rebound, and it is still going. Then when we look at the the agricultural resources, the wheat price has got a rounding characteristic reminiscent of what we saw in gold back in 2018. And it was in negative territory yesterday and a little overbought in the short term. But we've got a lot of crop news that's due soon. And with the floods in China and the droughts in Europe, then that does suggest that there are surprises on the way. When we think about the soybean price, Then it also has base formation characteristics and is pushing up and out of it in here this week. When we think about the corn market, then it took a hit because of the less demand for ethanol during the pandemic, but it is starting to rebound. The most important thing is that it's been in a base formation since 2014, and every time it has got down to around the $3 level, it has rebounded. So we're seeing that again in here right now. Then when we think about the coffee price, it's a very similar story. It had got all the way back down to the psychological dollar level, and then it's rebounded in here over the course of the last few weeks. And that is despite the fact that the real has been rather weak. Cocoa prices have been trending higher now albeit in a volatile manner, for about 3 years. And then, of course, you've got the sugar price. So one thing that we can think about is that there's plenty of evidence that agricultural commodities have bounced from previous areas of support, and they have by and large held their sequences of higher reaction lows since the lows in March. We're seeing increasing evidence that they are moving up and out of their base formations, perhaps not all at once, but certainly more in a sequential manner. The one big laggard is oil. I think it's important to highlight that one of the really significant factors that helped to really stoke commodity demand back in the early 2000s was the fact that oil prices broke out. And because oil is such an important input price in every other commodity, then it was a tailwind for demand for everything else. And then, of course, we had the advent of China into the WTO and the evolution of its both manufacturing base, but then also domestic demand. And that helped to stoke demand for every commodity against a background where there was limited supply. Well, oil prices pulled back additionally in here today. They've broken the sequence of higher reaction lows and confirmed resistance in the region of the trend mean. So now the question is, how low will it go? Will we get a higher reaction low? And will we subsequently see the price push back above the trend mean? But it is definitely now for the bulls to prove. The energy sector is uniquely unloved right now. There is a lot of uncertainty about the willingness of investors to continue to support the market. The S&P 500 energy sector has pushed down to a new reaction low as well in here this week. And it had been rolling over really since June. We've seen some very large companies like Shell canceling their dividend, and that's been a really significant factor in the price pulling back violently. Investors just don't have the confidence any longer that they're going to be rewarded. And this $1,000 level will need to hold if the benefit of the doubt is to be given to the upside. One thing that is clear is that the renewables sector has decoupled from the oil price. And the solar ETF had rallied really very impressively over the course of the last few weeks. And then we saw some dip buying coming through in here today. So we're certainly seeing that renewables are behaving more like technology shares. There's a couple of different factors that are really stoking demand for renewables, because they're no longer reacting to the correlation with energy prices. So they're no longer being priced based upon their ability to compete with an oil price. Rather, they're being priced in a different way. So on the one hand, it could be simply because of low interest rates, that we have got low interest rates. It's creating demand for growth everywhere, and for the internal rate of return that you can get in the energy sector, where Companies can go in and compete with a low cost of capital relative to utilities and capture market share, then investors will throw money at that all day, as long as they can capture that internal rate of return. Then there's the regulatory element to it. Tesla has been prospering based upon regulatory arbitrage for a decade already, and there are lots of other renewable energy companies are saying me too. So then those companies are benefiting because they are attracting additional capital simply on the basis that they can sell carbon credits. So that's an additional factor. I think it's less important about the technology innovation, although technological innovation is a significant potential promise for future productivity growth in the renewable sector. Now, we've certainly seen that a lot of enthusiasm has sprung up for the hydrogen sector. Now, it pulled back really very violently in here today, but it's still holding the sequence of higher reaction lows. And there's been a process of consolidation on for most of the last few months. Now, the big question is, are these kinds of speculative future renewable energy solutions going to continue to attract interest? I would suggest they probably will, as long as we have very low interest rates. So interest rates are a big factor in fueling the continued development of these solutions. When we then think about, well, what's going to happen when we do get a vaccine and confidence improves and central banks are printing money and governments are spending money on infrastructure and technology is continuing to promise these incredible solutions, and we've got a large number of really quite incredible solutions that have been proposed in just the last few weeks, reaching from wireless transmission using microwaves, or solar cells that are reportedly production ready, or in fact already in production, that have got 130% efficiency, or maybe nuclear batteries that can run off of nuclear waste and the graphite rods that are nuclear waste from fission reactors. I thought it was interesting that we are also seeing that the uranium sector is doing better, but it was not immune from the pullbacks that we saw in the last couple of days. So, for example, Denison Mines pulled back sharply in the last 2 days, and so did Cameco, pulling back and really failing to rebound with the wider market in here today. So if we can think about the future, it would be rational to think that nuclear will be a bigger portion of the market, but there is still a lot of resistance to building new nuclear reactors. Well, when we think about all these factors combined, then there is the potential that inflationary pressures rise, and that is something that could really upset the apple cart, because if we start to see longer dated yields starting to back up, then that's something that will have a meaningful effect on inflationary perceptions. And the only reason that investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt indefinitely to these high growth but zero profit technology companies is because of their growth potential. But that growth potential is predicated on access to continued funding. Now, 30-year yields didn't really pull back by all that much, and they're up again in a dynamic manner in here today. There is the potential that we're going to see the 30-year push back above the trend mean. I continue to think that 2% is a big psychological Rubicon for the 30-year. Now, when we also think about the gold price, gold has been going sideways for the last 6 weeks. I personally have been positioned for a deeper pullback, but we're not getting it. we're starting to see that institutional money is flowing into the sector. I did some back of the envelope calculations in here today, and what I found particularly interesting is that when we look at the index market cap for the NYSE Arca Gold Bugs Index, I can't figure out how they're coming up with that figure, because when we look at the number of gold miners in the world, well, there really aren't that many of them. So when we start to then think, well, there is obviously a very significant factor in terms of how do you value a precious metal mining operation. But the reality is that there are only 1,167 precious metal mines in the world, and not all of those shares are active. When we think about the market cap, there are really a very small handful are greater than about $1 billion. Unfortunately, this market cap is not currency adjusted. But we know, for example, that Barrick Gold and Newmont are the biggest are by far the largest gold miners in the world. And Newmont Mining has got a market cap of approximately $52 billion. Everything else is considerably smaller. By my calculations, if you took all of the miners, precious metal miners listed in the USA, Canada, Australia, and the UK, then the combined market cap would be something akin to Johnson & Johnson. So there are about 15 companies in the world that are considerably larger than all of the gold miners. In fact, if you took the cash from Apple, Google, and Facebook, just the cash sitting on their balance sheets, you could buy all of the gold miners in the world. So that's a very significant issue, because on the one hand, it's a limiting factor that institutions are going to find it difficult to buy gold miners. When you've got pension funds that are allocating about 5% to gold, well, they're either then buying gold outright, because the gold market itself is considerably larger than the gold mining sector. So we may simply have investors that are buying gold, or they're buying gold ETFs. And then when we think about the ETF holdings of gold, well, they have been trending higher for the last few years, and they've barely looked back during this consolidation over the course of the last 6 weeks. They were up another 85,000 ounces just yesterday. So there is obviously continued demand for gold. Unfortunately, I think that there's probably a lot of people that are like me, and they'd like to buy back in on the futures if there were an additional pullback. But we're seeing the same sort of dip buying in gold that we've seen in some of the technology shares. Gold prices are rallying for a reason. And then let's go back and think about, when did gold in fact break out? Well, gold completed its base formation in the middle of 2019. Prior to that, the Federal Reserve had been engaged in quantitative tightening. Well, they kind of gave up on quantitative tightening when they had to intervene to support the high yield market, and then they had to intervene in a big way to support the repo market. Well, the intervention in the repo market was around September, and gold had rallied during the contraction in repo liquidity. So now gold is a clear reflection of the pressure that central banks are under, that they cannot simply withdraw money from the system. The sensitivity of asset prices to higher interest rates is profound when you're at extremely low levels. And that means that we're going to have an environment where liquidity is going to be abundant for a long time. They will do whatever it takes to stoke inflation. The quantity of money that's been created, the debt to GDP ratios that we have right now are simply unmanageable, and therefore, we are likely to see a really quite significant change in investor behavior. Now, when we think about the correlation historically between emerging markets and gold, we've had a really significant divergence over the course of the last 12 months. We haven't had the same degree of interest in emerging markets that we had back in the 2000s. And a good part of the reason for that is the currency. The Asia Dollar Index is not quite breaking the sequence of lower rally highs. But back in 2000, the dollar had really peaked in 2001, and then Asian currencies took off. And that is equally true of Latin American currencies. And I just put that on the monthly chart. Well, if we go back to the 2000s, then the Asia Dollar Index bottomed in 2000, excuse me, the Latin America Dollar Index bottomed in 2002 and then rallied meaningfully all the way through until 2008. If we look at, for example, the Brazilian real, it had been one of the best performing currencies in the world all the way up from the lows in 2000. Then really, excuse me, it weakened significantly up to 2002. And then from 2002 through to 2008, the currency doubled. It went from 4 to better than 2. Well, we just don't have that now. Now, we may be potentially in a situation where the real is putting in some support in the region of 5.5 or below 6, but it's going to take a meaningful move to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. So this divergence that we're seeing in terms of gold and then also for emerging markets has a lot to do with the currency and the relative weakness of some of those currencies. But some of the ingredients are beginning to fall into place that should help to stoke interest in emerging markets. The first is that the Chinese renminbi is strengthening, or at least it's not declining any in a big way any longer. Now, the renminbi was weaker in here today, and it is overbought in the short term, so we may see some consolidation, but it's not trending down like it did between 2018 and early 2020. So many countries depend on trade with China that they would much prefer to have a weaker currency relative to China that would boost the value of their exports, not least to countries that they compete with China for, and then also for China with China itself. The other factor that generally helps to stoke interest in emerging markets is the yield differential. Well, the Indonesian rupee, rupiah, for example, it weakened substantially during the pandemic. Then it pulled, it strengthened again and recouped the entire loss. Now, we've certainly had some weakness over the course of the last few days, and it is steadying around the region of the trend mean. But I think one thing that, sorry, I haven't got this graphic open in front of me just yet. Let me open that one. It's the Indonesia yield. It's around 7%. The Indian yield is approximately 6%. If you look at the FX implied yields, well, then you're still picking up 500 odd basis points in Indonesian rupiahs or in Indian rupees. It's a lot less in the Chinese renminbi. You just don't have it at all in the Vietnamese dong. But even the Philippine peso, and the Philippine peso has been strengthening for more than a year, you're still picking up a carry of 200 basis points. So that carry trade demand is something that could certainly help to boost demand for emerging markets next year. One thing that is derailing the recovery that we're in demand from institutional or global investors for emerging markets is the coronavirus, that there is still a uncontrolled spread in a lot of Latin America. The weakness in the global economy has been a factor that's inhibited a lot of speculation in the Asian region. And there's still a lot of uncertainty about the economic outlook, so that's also a delaying factor. But there is the clear potential that if we do get recovery and synchronized global economic expansion next year, then we're going to see a lot more interest in the Asian region, and most particularly where investors have the scope for a strengthening currency. Well, the Indian rupee has been strengthening. The RBI has been of the view that they should allow the currency to appreciate in order to contain inflationary pressures. So that is helping to stoke interest. Then, when we think about government bond yields, well, the nominal yield is certainly attractive. There's been a significant compression in the yield since the end of 2018. But if that is also accompanied by a stronger rupee, then that's particularly attractive to institutional investors. It's, I think, one of the significant factors that has helped the Nifty to appreciate. Now, the Nifty did put in a large downside key reversal at the beginning of September, so we are due some consolidation, and I think that the additional weakness we saw today is confirmation that we are in a period of consolidation for the Nifty, and not least because the strengthening of the currency is a bit of a headwind in the short term. But these are straws in the wind that are potentially going to represent a significant return of interest for emerging markets as we move further into the recovery stage from the pandemic. We're in an environment that is still uncertain. There is a lot of speculative interest. We've seen really incredible advances in a large number of technology shares. Broadly speaking, it's the stay-at-home sector that has done best, and then the semiconductors have also done phenomenally well. Advanced Micro Devices has pulled back sharply. It's definitely a failed upside break, but it's well off the lows. What it suggests is we're getting two-way action. Now, there's a lot of speculative interest from the retail sector. That's generally representative of the of late-stage activity. There's a lot of enthusiasm for solutions to technological problems that are not yet mature. That's also representative of the late stage in the bull market environment. We've also seen that growth has been outperforming for a prolonged period of time, so that's also representative of the late stage. But the thing that really knocks out a big bull market and a mania is higher interest rates. And until we get higher interest rates, then we're unlikely to see a very meaningful top arise. But the sensitivity that the market has to interest rates means that prices are going to be extremely sensitive to any whiff of a tighter liquidity environment. It's not like other cycles where the market has continued to rally well into a period where interest rates have been rising. We should remind ourselves that the Federal Reserve was in the process of creating a recession with its quantitative tightening program. They took approximately $750 billion out of circulation, and they raised rates progressively all the way through that time when they were reducing the size of the balance sheet. From 2016 through to 2019, they added 2.25% to the interest rate. And that eventually choked off speculative interest. That's when we started to see liquidity problems. Well, on this occasion, considering the massive increase in liquidity, then we're much more sensitive to interest rates. And not least because we're still at close to zero and bond yields are really at extraordinarily depressed levels. That means that we're in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. We've already seen the accelerations. We've seen a pause in those accelerations this week. If we see these accelerations picking up again after the big downward dynamics we saw earlier this week, then we are very clearly in the final stages of this bull market. But it's unlikely to end until we, in fact, get a real interest rate scare. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.